Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today in a jam-packed lineup, which leaves me little time for patter. In moments, the historian Nancy McLean will talk about the right's response to Obama's election in 2008 and what it might portend for its reaction against Biden, who in their fevered minds is a socialist, as if that would be a bad thing, were it true. And then climate specialist Tom Athanasiou will talk about what the U.S. return to the Paris Agreement means. First, the right. Nancy McLean, who teaches history at Duke, was on this show back in June 2017 to discuss her freshly published book, Democracy in Chains, a look at how right-wing economists like James Buchanan, founder of what would be known as the Virginia School of Political Economy, and philanthropists like Charles Koch, who hardly needs any further identification, have shaped our politics over the last several decades. In contrast with the more famous Chicago School of Right-Wing Economics, which focuses mainly on private markets, the Virginia School is highly concerned with the public sector, in particular, minimizing its interference with private actors. Its origins are inseparable from Southern opposition to school desegregation in the 1950s and 60s, a pedigree that still marks its politics today, though it annoys the hell out of adherents when you point this out. Nancy McLean had a chapter in that book about the right's response to Obama's election, but it was cut for various editorial reasons. It's now been published in a collection, Capitalism Contested, The New Deal and Its Legacies, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Nancy McLean. The other day I was watching a video book launch featuring Charles Koch about his latest work. He and his Cato interlocutor, they were the sponsor of this thing, were going on about how they're all so bottoms up. The left was always so top down. I was stunned by the chutzpah of making that sort of claim. Talk a little generally about precisely how top-down this whole Koch operation is.
Yeah, I think I might be the only person on the left who's read that new Charles Koch book all the way through. Such bad faith, diabolical. It's like he's found a new language to cover all that he's done over the years in this new language and make it sound like something that it is absolutely not. There's absolutely no capacity for bottom-up control in any enterprise he ever started, right? So Americans for Prosperity has chapters. They claim they have members, but those members have absolutely no way of affecting what decisions are made or what goes on at the top of the operation. And that in some ways just mirrors the structure of Koch Industries, which is led by and dominated by has-been Charles Koch, you know, since forever. Now, having said that,
David was very much a second banana, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. David was a latecomer, a gadfly. And yeah, Charles was the serious one, the one who stayed in Wichita and couldn't be bothered with Lincoln Center in New York and the other kinds of things that David was patronizing. Charles was trying to change the world and has, really. Like a smart manager, he grasped the importance of a division of labor and of creating incentives for people to do what you want them to do. And they've done that very effectively. But there's no way that this is a bottom-up operation. And in fact, the book itself is so deeply cynical on that. They continue to put out a case of this African-American hair braider. I can't remember, from Mississippi, Louisiana. But this goes way back. This is like Clint Bolick, the legal thinker and strategist who works with Koch, who's now on the Arizona Supreme Court, was litigating cases like hair braiding to try to end occupational licensure, right, as part of rolling back the New Deal state, laying the legal and constitutional groundwork for that. So they flash a few photos of people of color that they hold up like that, as they have Van Jones. But really, it is so profoundly cynical. I mean, they are trying to undermine the capacity of people to engage in bottom-up social change as we know it. And in fact, to be able to have any ability to affect the major kinds of decisions government makes, particularly those involving tax transfers and regulation, which are basically the most important things that government does.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about this chapter. I imagine there's a considerable bit of alarm in the Koch network when Obama won in 2008. A lot of people on the left expected something out of Obama, but certainly didn't see him as a socialist. But to people of the Koch persuasion, well, what does socialist mean to them? They think in some sense that Obama was a socialist, right?
Yes, absolutely. And they think you and I are socialists and the library
is
down at the town library.
I don't deny the label.
This is a case where Democrats don't pay attention to the resources that are out there to inform them for these battles, because what they should have done with these allegations about socialism is completely turn it back on the right and on the Kochs, on the Republicans, and say, yeah, you all think public libraries are socialist, public schools are socialist, Social Security is socialist. You know, you want to get rid of all these incredibly popular things. The post office, they tried to get rid of the post office in not pushing back hard against that to put the Kochs on the defensive. Democrats will just never cease finding more places to run to and hide, I think. It's very unfortunate.
The Rick Santelli moment was very important to the evolution of this reactionary reaction to Obama. How spontaneous was that Rick Santelli moment?
Santelli, you know, when he stood up on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade and denounced the socialism of having people who were in trouble from bad mortgages get government assistance, this was trumpeted as this great new moment. He actually called for capitalists to come, you know, and assemble. But this was incredibly helpful to the Koch network and Freedom Works in particular, led by Dick Armey, because they had been trying to conjure a Tea Party unsuccessfully for many years before that happened. So suddenly there were these groups that were starting up that didn't actually have particular coordination among them in the beginning, but they were encouraged by Fox News. They were pumped up as though they were bigger than they were. And then almost instantly, figures like Dick Armey from the Koch network kind of put themselves ahead of this upheaval and wrote manifestos for them, supplied buses for them to go to demonstrations and to go to town hall meetings on the healthcare plan and disrupt. So a tremendous amount of coordination that was going on that most of us were utterly unaware of then. So that's my fear for now, is that not having paid attention to what happened the last time, we could really blow it again. I remember so vividly when one of the Republican members in Congress after the election in 2008 said that their party was in such dire straits. He said that if we were dog food, they'd take us off the shelf. Like, if we were dog food, they'd get real. And then, like, how did they come back? And they
2 years later.
They think much more strategically than we do. You know, and I think this has changed a lot since 2017. I think there's much better communication and coordination on what we might call the broad left. But there are so many competing silos. There is so little message discipline. There's so little shared focus that is very hard for us, even though our ideas are much more popular, even though there's more creative talent. There's so many more good things, I think, on the progressive side, but they're not aligned in a way that would enable us to operate with the kind of determination and well-conceived strategy that our opponents have.
I've been long impressed by the structure of the production and distribution of ideas these folks have come up with. So going back to Mont Pelerin, and then Koch developed this, his thinker Richie Fink developed this. They had this idea of like peak institutions, peak intellectuals who develop the raw ideas. They could distribute through think tanks and then journalists. Very hierarchical, systematic, and very clever at linking big policy ideas, or big philosophical ideas, rather, with specific policies. I mean, they had the whole production and distribution of ideas and policies really down, right? It's an incredibly effective machine.
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, will sometimes talk about the Koch brothers, and of course, David has passed, as you mentioned, or the Koch network. But I think most people do not actually understand what we're talking about when we say that. So we are talking about quite literally hundreds of organizations, right? We're talking about national organizations, you know, including Americans for Prosperity, the Federalist Society, things like that. We're talking about a state policy network that has over 150 members doing this work at the state level, organizing outfits for veterans, for Latinos, you know, for young people to turn them against Social Security. It's just such a complex and interwoven operation that is also deliberately designed to make it so that most people don't understand that all the pieces are connected.
Yeah, I mean, the organization chart would look like something that Glenn Beck wrote, right? But it's
Exactly. And they always project, you know, I mean, like whatever they say about us, you know that that's probably something that they're doing. But the other piece of what they've done that's become so powerful is the campus network. So they are giving money to over 300 campuses now. George Mason, which I wrote about in Democracy in Chains, is the flagship campus and kind of the home base for a lot of these organizations. But they have a growing number of centers. And just to illustrate your point about the top-down distribution of ideas, so they will fund the think tanks that come up with these ideas. They also fund the scholars who produce them. And they fund the whole career of some of these people through something called the Institute for Humane Studies. So they get these scholars, then they get, you know, them out into the universities, and they fund them to create these centers, which have stipulations that most donors don't ever put on a university gift. And then they use the campus center to conquer high schools. For example, we're seeing in Arizona, where it turned out that the college campus center at the University of Arizona developed a teacher training program to bring teachers in for professional development credit and send them home with a Koch curriculum on political economy for the high school.
So when Obama's elected and there's this fear of creeping socialism or marauding socialism or however they saw it, what was their mobilization like? I know they mobilized on many fronts, but give us some summary idea of just how they had all hands on deck.
Yeah, well, I think maybe thinking about the Affordable Care Act and the mobilization against that would be illustrative. I mean, clearly there was a mobilization. The first mobilization was against the financial stimulus package, which, of course, is so relevant to what we're facing now with the Biden administration. And already Americans for Prosperity is out there, you know, beating the drums, trying to get people out to oppose the COVID stimulus package that almost 80% of people support. No, I guess it's not that high. I think it's like 66 or 69%.
I'm speaking with the historian Nancy McLean. Yeah, now it's interesting now the politics is different now because that package is very widely supported, whereas there's a lot more skepticism about the financial bailout.
That's true. And also there was, at that point, there was a kind of cacophony of voices on the progressive side, too. So, you know, there was a sense that, yes, we need a stimulus package, but what would it be? And frankly, I remember, you know, I was on a group of feminist thinkers on a listserv, and everybody started saying, oh, you know, it's not supporting care work and birth control. And there's just complete cacophony on our side while we were facing this kind of incoming missile that was determined to destroy the whole thing. So, and again, at that point, we didn't know what we were looking at, right? We didn't have Jane Mayer's investigative journalism about the Koch network. We didn't have the experience of all these groups in the trenches who now understand what they're dealing with. So we were sort of operating blind, but you could see that something was happening that was very disturbing and was very new and was very well coordinated, you know, as in Fox continuing to give oxygen to any tiny little protest at the time until they made it with the attention, helped to build up the ranks. But I guess one thing that really stays with me, too, is how the buses of people from their network, you know, allegedly from grassroots Tea Party, but actually funded by these central donor groups, busloads of people were coming down to town hall meetings and shutting them down, right? Making it impossible to communicate in the model, in a way, you know, minus the crazy outfits and weapons, but what we saw on January 6th, right? Just this real street action to make civil discourse impossible and to make it appear that there was huge public opposition to providing health care, when in fact that was not the case. But they create, you know, enough of a hall of mirrors that they make themselves the issue. I think another interesting thing to look at from those early years, which I do write about in this piece, is the attacks on Acorn, which were so crazy when they were happening. And, you know, we're all like, I mean, we knew that there was a right and that they did some things in coordination, but the Acorn attacks were just so bizarre with the entrapment and the absurd videos and such that it really took people by surprise and made it so that they were able to defund one of the largest networks of community organizations, the largest network of community organizations, a crucial organization in voter registration and a really important voice for low-income people who were largely not in the organized labor movement. And like that, the right took them out. And again, through dishonest video, through 24/7 coverage in the media, making this organization that had done so much valuable work so toxic in the eyes of politicians that they all rushed to disassociate themselves. And by the time they figured out that they'd been had by this dishonest videographer, whose name is escaping me at the
moment.
Yeah, James O'Keefe, and now he's Project Veritas with like a $300,000 salary. So the right loves him, and they use him to train people. They're still using him to train people, even as he's been exposed for having done totally dishonest work that sometimes makes people say the exact opposite of what they're actually saying. But the right doesn't care because in short order, they were able to take out a crucial organization on the progressive side. And then they actually went on from that to talk about giving Planned Parenthood the acorn treatment. You know, I don't think Charles Koch has any particular opinions about abortion, but they do understand that Planned Parenthood is the most effective lobby for public health. 3% of its services are abortion. Otherwise, they're doing important public health work for low-income people in lobbying for programs that will provide that work. So this Koch network and its strategists have wanted to take out Planned Parenthood for a long time and totally willing, again, to do it with dishonest video entrapment if that's what it takes. So, and we even saw that with a group here, Democracy North Carolina, that's been really important over the years in opening up the electorate and fighting corruption. And they were subject to that, an effort at that kind of video treatment this summer. So these operations just continue and continue. And I think it's crucial that we understand them so that when these moments come up where there's such a frenzy, there are people ready to say, don't believe it for a second.
Well, speaking of North Carolina, you've got a mini Koch in your neighborhood, right? Art Pope. He is an example of the geographic expansiveness of the Koch operation. I mean, he's part of that network, but then he's done a lot to fund these sorts of politics at the state level, right? And particularly redistricting.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, people often refer to Art Pope as the Koch cousin. He's worked with them since the 1980s. He's on the board of Americans for Prosperity. He was made budget director by Governor McCrory when he came to office in North Carolina. Some Democratic legislators told me that Art Pope would sit in on committee meetings and hearing meetings and just sort of sit in the back corner to kind of watch how his investment was going, right? Make sure nobody's out of line. But of course, they keep the scorecards, too, to intimidate and cow elected officials and bend them to the donor purposes. But your point, I think, about how widespread this is really crucial. I think another place where progressives have really fallen down, but again, are now realizing the error, is in focusing on policy at the state level. The left is great about running local initiatives and local campaigns and blue cities and, you know, making things happen at the local level. And there's a lot of interest in presidential elections and in congressional elections, but particularly through the Obama years, and Obama bears a lot of responsibility for this, Democrats completely ignored the state level and didn't alert us all that 2010 was a redistricting year, you know? And so much of the havoc that Republicans have wrought has happened at the state level. And that was a great tragedy of the 2020 election. And I think the fact that Democrats were much more careful about the pandemic and not wanting to infect people. So there was not grassroots door knocking. And as a result, no legislatures were recaptured by progressives. The Republicans control 30 states now. Right. And they have the census. They have this flawed Trump census that they will do redistricting from. And they can have the power, as you said, you know, to pass voter suppression legislation, to starve the schools, to shift resources to private schools in the hopes of ultimately privatizing public education. So if folks on the progressive side do not start paying significant attention to state level politics, it could be game over.
It seems that they realize that they can't win straight elections. They need the Electoral College, they need gerrymandering, and they need voter suppression to win elections.
Yeah, that was my single most important finding in Democracy in Chains, was to see them saying again and again, like they realize they will never win a majority. Like Charles Koch said, you know, at this key moment in 1997, he said, since we are greatly outnumbered, the failure to use our superior technology ensures failure. This technology of rigging the rules, basically, of our political system. They understand that they cannot win majorities for their politics. You know, if we didn't have a slaveholder's constitution that overrepresented all these states with no population, we'd live in a very different country. I think there's been 250 bills proposed in state legislatures since the election to suppress the vote in different ways, you know, to get rid of mail-in balloting, to shrink early voting, to have voter ID, you know, to do all these things because they understand they can't win. the right as it's constituted now cannot win on issues without systematic disinformation. They practiced this, the Koch Network folks did, with early work with the tobacco industry in the 1980s, then with fossil fuels, and of course Koch Industries is fossil fuel based, climate science disinformation, and voter fraud is the same thing.
I know historians don't like speculating in the future, but I'll ask this anyway. Now, aside from this activity at the state level, where do you see them trying to fight Biden? And now we actually have, not large, but it's not tiny, we have socialists in Congress, we have socialists in state legislatures and city councils. There is more of a serious threat coming from the left than there was 12 years ago. What do you see their reactions likely to be?
Once you understand how they operate and, you know, and what the end game is, I think one can begin to anticipate moves. And, well, I think we're seeing some of it, continuing to promote this big lie that there's a lot of voter fraud and a flawed system that requires voter suppression. Americans for Prosperity is already, and, you know, I'm on the mailing list. So I know what they tell their people. They never give people the full story. They give them just a little snippet that they want acted upon. So they'll be trying to undermine the COVID relief bill after being the people who are pushing reopening. The biggest place to look will be state legislatures and then the courts. In the Obama years, the right-wing Republican-controlled state set up the RAGA, the Republican Attorneys General Association. So I think we can expect litigation against anything that the Biden administration tries to do coming from those coordinated state attorneys general. And then, of course, now, thanks to Mitch McConnell and all of these operations working together, we have a 6-3 majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. They're going to come fast and hard at regulation in general and at the administrative state and at the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, as it's been understood by the courts since 1937 to authorize federal regulation. And so if they can take that out, and some groundwork has already been laid on that, if they can take that out, it's not game over, but then it means like it's just a whole different field of struggle, right, at that point. So the courts are going to be a crucial battleground as well as state legislatures.
And finally, we don't want to lie and cheat, but what can we learn from these people?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you asked that, Doug, because I do think that sometimes on the left, there's like the smarty pants syndrome. Those of your listeners who are old enough to remember the Gore-Bush debates where everybody went in thinking Gore was going to do so well, and actually he was so kind of schoolmarmy and condescending that it hurt him. So I think there's a tendency on the left to think our folks are the smartest folks out there and not give the other side credit for being very intelligent and being very strategic. That would be a place to start to recognize the importance of a long-term strategy, which the right has had. You know, you mentioned the Mont Pelerin Society that was founded in 1947. You know, they have been developing deep strategy for a very long time now. So the need for a progressive long game, I think, also the need to take ideas seriously and to take learning seriously.
Yeah, that's important because there's this tendency on the left to be scornful of academics and intellectuals in the name of being populist. And clearly Koch and his comrades take this very seriously.
Yes, absolutely. They do a lot more popular education at this point, quite frankly, than we do. You know, their ideas are flawed. They're terrible dogma. But, you know, they're like the old pre-Vatican Catholic Church or something in the way they inculcate them. I mean, they actually, on some campuses, they pay students to come to their seminars and workshops, you know, to try to steep them in these ideas when so many progressives can't even have funded internships to train young organizers and activists and thinkers. So anyway, so having a long-term developing long-term strategy, taking ideas seriously, and then working across these silos, which will be the death of us. And, you know, one of the figures I wrote about in the book is this James McGill Buchanan, who invented public choice thought. And, you know, there's a lot of problems with it. But one of the things that he pointed to was the personal stakes that people have in organizations or in government agencies or things like that. And, you know, he went too far, et cetera. But I think there is a way that people on the left need to start having really honest conversations about what they're doing and the way they're operating is actually advancing the whole movement and the struggle for the vast majority and for all of us, or if it's about organizational self-perpetuation, right? And elbowing out the group that does the same thing as you with the grantor because you want to get the grant for your program rather than their program. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff that I think needs to be aired, needs to have much more open and honest discussion. Maybe funders can also play a positive role. I've had people who are in the trenches with various really good organizations who have pushed me and Democracy in Chains to their funders to say, you're part of the problem. You know, because many of these foundations have pushed people to focus on local issues, on winnable campaigns, on trackable metrics, rather than investing in really smart thinkers who have a vision or, you know, in bringing groups together to work on common national big scale problems where that foundation may not be able to claim it, that's its success, but they could be part of a larger solution, you know, involving other unions, community groups, other foundations, et cetera. So I think trying to get the ego out of it is my simple way to summarize that, you know, and say, hey, if we're the side that's really about collective power and social justice, then maybe our day-to-day conduct should be in keeping with that.
That was Nancy McLean, a professor of history at Duke and author of Democracy in Chains, which appeared in 2017, and of a chapter cut from that volume, which has now been published in a collection from the University of Pennsylvania Press called Capitalism Contested. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break. Some of Stimulus of Loss for flutes and Alm Martinon, an electronic instrument that's a cousin of the theremin. It was composed by Suzanne Farron and performed by Claire Chase, whom we've heard from several times over the last few months. This track was released on Bandcamp in December, though it's not exactly a new recording. There's a video of Chase on YouTube that shows in charming detail just what she does to her flute to get it to make sounds like that. One alteration, allowing the mouthpiece to slide up and down like a trombone. Next, the U.S. returns to the Paris Climate Accords. What does that mean? What does Biden mean for climate politics? What does an apparent, though quite partial, shift in Wall Street consciousness around climate mean? Here with some answers is Tom Athanasiou, Executive Director of EcoEquity, a small California-based think tank that, as its name suggests, emphasizes fairness and justice in its approach to climate. The interview takes off for a piece Tom published on the Nation's website on February 19th. Tom Athanasiou. So the U.S. is going back into the Paris Agreement. What exactly does that mean? What is the Paris Agreement, and what did the U.S.'s absence from it mean, and what does it mean to go back?
In order to stabilize the climate system, we have to act globally as well as nationally. The question is, how do you act globally given the disorganized nature of modern governance? We don't have anything like a coordinated international economy. It's a war of all against all, and in that context, how do you have any hope of stabilizing the climate system?
Parenthetically, it's interesting that 20 years ago, 25 years ago, we were talking about the IMF and the World Bank as institutions of global governance, you know, the way that the rich countries lorded it over the poor ones. These institutions are a shadow of their former selves, so all the mechanisms of global governance just seem to be, what, the financial markets at this point?
Exactly. I mean, Naomi Klein had a couple of really excellent points in her big climate book, and one of them was that it was our bad luck to get to the level of manifest global environmental crisis during the time of neoliberalism. It was really, really bad timing. People are saying that we're now in the rubble of neoliberalism, but is it bad time to have rubble where there used to be government? Or maybe there didn't even used to be government. Yeah, you're right. The WTO is locked up, basically unable to get anything done. The climate negotiations have been a terrible slog and did manage to achieve a breakthrough in 2015 called the Paris Agreement. That breakthrough was not what we would have chosen. Paris was definitely Plan B. But that said, we may be better off having a Plan B than we are, say, in the international trade negotiations or with respect to international health coordination. At least we have a Plan B when it comes to climate. It's probably worthwhile saying what Plan A would have been. You remember 2009, there was this huge climate summit that year as well in Copenhagen, and some of the more naive folks in our world called it Hopenhagen, and they thought that there was going to be a meeting of the minds. They thought that the statesmen and stateswomen of the world would get together and they would come up with a cooperative agreement in which each country would be allocated an emissions reduction target that was appropriate to its national circumstances, and that those targets would add up to an emergency globalization, and that didn't happen.
Well, I mean, now that you mention it, it seems kind of hard to imagine how it would ever happen. I mean, I can't imagine the U.S. Congress ever assenting to an arrangement like that.
That's exactly right. And people on the left of the climate movement were so mad that they didn't get that they didn't recognize that what they got was actually a thing. I want to give it a name. It knocked around in international relations theory for a couple of decades. It's called pledge and review. The idea of pledge and review is that you have this massive collective action problem, the climate crisis, and you don't have a central authority. So how do you solve the problem? And the idea of pledge and review was that each nation would make a pledge, and those pledges would be transparent. All other national communities would be able to see them in detail, and they would all be added up and assessed by the scientific community, in this case, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the IPCC, and compared against what the science says is necessary. And countries would not only make pledges of what they were going to do on their own nickel, but they would also make pledges of what they were going to do if they got assistance from other wealthier countries. And this would happen over and over again. These pledges would be evaluated by the scientific community every 5 years. That would create a dynamic cycle of ever-increasing ambition, and it would give us a chance.
So what would the enforcement mechanism be other than shaming?
That's a really good question, and the usual answer goes back to your point about the WTO being a mess, because if you were really serious about this, you would have to use the World Trade System as an enforcement mechanism. You would have to say that countries that were not doing their fair share would have their goods restricted from international trade. That's still the dream.
I can think of a very large country that we're both sitting in would never agree to anything like this.
Yeah, you can. But on the other hand, people are beginning to panic.
Do you detect a shift in public opinion?
The polls indicate a shift in public thinking about it. The majority of the American people, including a significant number of Republicans, want to act on climate. On the other hand, we can have that on the other hand conversation, right?
Yes, you need a lot of hands for this kind of conversation.
But yeah, there has been a shift, and things like Texas are going to accelerate the shift. Texas may go blue because of the catastrophe that just occurred down there. It's not a one-act play that we're in.
Let's get back to the Paris specifically. What does it mean that the United States is going back in? What did our absence do, and what does going back in mean?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't think anybody knows the answer yet. There's a couple of different ways to approach it. One is that Biden says he wants to make America a climate leader again, and the question is, what would that mean? My own position is that the only way we're really going to get this dynamic cycle of the climate negotiations to really yield a high ambition transition is if countries' actions are evaluated by observers, scientists, other countries, activists, an ever more sophisticated context in which people are asking of every country, is it doing its fair share? And people are developing an ever more sophisticated notion of what that means. True climate leadership from that perspective would mean that the United States is re-entering the negotiations and proposing to do its fair share, but that's not going to happen. And I can tell you it's not going to happen because a group of us working within the U.S. Climate Action Network, which was once a staid Washington-based network of mostly mainline organizations and is now a well-functioning intersectional justice-forward network. We put together a fair shares report that indicated that for the United States to do its fair share, it would have to reduce its emissions by about 195%, which means 70% reduction domestically by 2030, and then a financial and technological assistance to poorer countries equivalent to 125% of American emissions in order for it to do its fair share. Now, we know that's not going to happen while the United States is still locked in slow civil war. The United States is not going to come back to the negotiations and do its proper fair share. And maybe it could do something like what Bernie Sanders proposed, that the United States reduce its emissions by 70% instead of another 125% in international support. Bernie proposed another 90% in international support. And then he did a very forgiving analysis of what that would cost and said that it would be $200 billion in international support over a 10-year period. So in other words, he proposed that we reduce our emissions by 70%, plus we give $200 billion to the Green Climate Fund.
Now, even if you double or triple that number to 400 or 600, by the standards of the federal budget over the course of a decade, that's not a hell of a lot of money.
That's not a hell of a lot of money. That's exactly right. Now, it was very charitable. Maybe it's going to cost more than that to reduce emissions at this incredibly rapid pace. But who knows? There's an immense technology transition going on. As you know, capitalism is an extremely dynamic system. So who's to say that it isn't possible?
Speaking of public opinion, what do you make of what's been going on in the Wall Street world lately? I mean, you've got Larry Fink and BlackRock talking about environmental goals and corporate governance. One of Biden's top economic advisors, Brian Deese, comes out of BlackRock, that branch of BlackRock. How seriously should we take this? How important is it? Or is it just a bunch of greenwashing?
Well, it's not just a bunch of greenwashing. You don't want to give them too much credit, right? But the pace of the technology transition is now reaching is such that there's going to be a lot of money lost in fossil energy, just under business as usual. So, of course, they're repositioning.
Well, now this is what Mark Carney was saying at the Bank of England like 5 years ago, that financial prudence dictates taking account to the fact that a lot of these assets are going to be worthless perhaps sooner than anybody imagines.
Yeah, there's a dark side to Carney, too, a bull side. He's on the board of something called Brookfield Energy Partners, which is the largest renewables company in Canada. He's been advocating some pretty accounting techniques.
But does it change the politics of climate significantly to have at least these characters acknowledging that something needs to be done?
I think so. I mean, you know, I just cracked Bill Gates's book this morning over coffee, so I can't really make a judgment on it. But Mr. Gates is saying we really do need to get to global net zero by 2050. If you think about that, that's amazing. And that includes Russia and Nigeria and South Africa and Brazil, not just Europe and the United States. It includes the entire developing world. You can advocate for a technology-first strategy as if technology was going to save us. But in your heart, you have to know that getting to net zero by 2050 is going to involve massive changes at every level. I mean, if you read between the lines in the most recent, or not even between the lines, in the most recent IPCC reports, they just come out and say everything has to change. It's not everything. To guys like us, you know, we want to see social relations fundamentally remodeled, but the kind of infrastructural transitions that will be necessary in order to achieve anything like net zero are going to spill far beyond business as usual. Do people know? They kind of do.
For a long time, I was saying that we had a serious ruling class who would actually be able to talk and think seriously about climate change. And until fairly recently, I felt pretty secure in that opinion and that we didn't have one. But it does seem at least portions of it are having some kind of scales fall off the eyes.
That's an interesting way to put it. So you have guys like Bill Gates, we'll call them as serious members of the ruling class. And then you have guys like Trump, who will call them something else, right? And what does that mean when you have that kind of a split? That's really the question. What does this mean for socialist politics? What does it mean for green politics? What does it mean for democracy? All of that stuff is on the table now. It's kind of an amazing moment. The big challenge for us is to look at it with clear eyes, to see what's actually happening and what's actually at stake without sinking into despair and without making these ultra-left judgments about the fact that we're trapped in a plan B world, that we don't get what we wanted.
I'm speaking with the climate activist, Tom Athanasiou. A framework like Paris will only work, as you've been arguing, that if there's significant transfer of technology and money to the poorer countries of the world. What are the prospects of that actually happening?
We just had the 5th anniversary of Paris, right? Which means the end of the first pledging cycle and time for every country to come back to the table and make its second pledge, which is supposed to be stronger than its first pledge. And so now Biden is definitely going to do that. They're jamming to write the new U.S. NDC. It means nationally determined contribution. We call it a pledge. It's going to be announced on April 22nd at the big summit that the Biden administration is spinning up. It's not going to be a net zero 2050 pledge, but it's going to be very ambitious. In this context where the pledging cycle is turning, countries all around the world are announcing that they're going to aim for net zero 2050, which is what we have to do globally. But a lot of these countries don't have the resources to do it. So what we know is those resources have to be mobilized. Developing countries or poor countries or less than rich countries who want to move really ambitiously, they have to be supported. One way of doing that is with fair shares and international financial transfers. Another way of doing it is with a global currency of some kind, some sort of global version of modern monetary theory. You know, and I think we have to be realistic about this. Either one would do.
Now, how does China fit into all this, both as emitter and also funder?
That's a really good question. I know you haven't really spent a lot of your life in the UN system, but in the UN system, there's the North and the South, right? And there's the developing countries and the developed countries, and it's very polarized.
Yeah, and China has one foot in each of those camps.
That's right. China, as part of this second pledging cycle, just about 3 or 4 months ago, pledged net zero 2060. Now, they're a quote-unquote developing country, so they gave themselves an extra 10 years. But China has pledged to have a net zero economy by 2060. There's a lot of questions, not only about crooked accounting, but also about how trade works into this. The Chinese want or say they want to make a climate transition. They're queuing themselves up to win by dominating solar, dominating electric vehicles, dominating wind technology. So they think they can compete, and they're probably right. But yeah, they're on board.
Well, then how about funding the poorer countries, since China, although technically a poor country, has a lot of money?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. If you were going to do fair shares properly, the way you would do it is that each country would act in accordance to its capacity and its responsibility, but mostly its capacity. And in many cases, most cases, ability is a function of national wealth. But you also have the technological capacity into account. You have to take internal distribution of wealth into account, and you have to take institutions into account. But however you do the calculation, and there isn't going to be agreement on this in the short term, China has a lot of capacity. And so China should be on the donor side of the ledger.
How much hope should we invest in the Biden administration? Could something good come out of this next 4 years?
You tell me what you think. I mean, I'm as interested in your answer to that question as you are to mine. Give me something.
I think that the foreign policy of the Biden administration is going to be pretty much standard, what we used to call Cold War Democrat, as we saw, you know, by the recent attack in Syria. But on the other hand, on domestic policy, to use the language of Wall Street, they seem to be coming in above expectations. The economic policy seems somewhat better than I expected. The personnel seemed better than I expected. To see the Secretary of the Treasury talking about structural racism and climate change as being part of the Treasury's mission now, they're talking well. Some of the people look pretty good. I know two of the people on the Council of Economic Advisers, which is certainly an unprecedented event. So, you know, on that side, you know, maybe it won't be terrible. The other night, Biden said everyone who wants to join a union should be allowed to join a union. He's talking up the unionization effort at Amazon in Alabama. So I was pleasantly surprised by that, too. So, you know, I don't follow the climate as closely as you do, but on the economic policy side, it could be a lot worse.
Yeah, and I would say that generally the structure of my answer on the climate policy side is the same. I was in a meeting on Friday with several members of the U.S. negotiating team, including the head of the U.S. climate negotiating team, Trig Taley, who, when asked by a militant from the ActionAid organization what he was going to do, what they were going to do about ensuring that the United States met its fair share, he said, I hear you. I hear the chorus of voices on fair shares. And all I can say to you is that we're going to get as close to doing our fair share as is possible, given our system. That was his answer.
Given the Senate and the Yahoos and all that business.
Yeah, I mean, so you could say that's bullshit. But on the other hand, we know that basically the South won the Civil War. At this point, that's sure how it looks to me. And so there are constraints. And, you know, until they deal with the Senate, you have to take the nature of our system into account. I mean, the thing is, I'm very much a fair shares guy because I think the political discourses that are engendered by, within all nations, by social movements demanding a conversation of their government. Is their government doing its fair share with respect to the planetary crisis? I think we need to have that conversation. In practice, I think something like a global Keynesian magic wand is going to be necessary. What we know is that until they stop pumping money into fossil energy, everything they say is bullshit. But the European Central Bank and the IMF and the multilateral development banks are all publicly declaring that they're going to retreat from fossil subsidies at an accelerated rate. What are we going to do about the private banks? According to the Rainforest Action Network's excellent annual Banking on Climate report, there has been $2.7 trillion invested in fossils since the Paris Agreement was signed at the end of 2015. How are we going to stop that? It's not necessary for there to be a socialist revolution in the United States for the government of the United States to somehow increase the cost to Chase and BlackRock and Vanguard and all the other major fossil funders. There's got to be something they can do to re-regulate capital. One way to think about it, and this is the way the climate movement always thinks about it, is in terms of public finance. But what about the regulation of private finance? And if the governments are really locked up by right-wing blocking coalitions and unable to provide large international financial and technology transfers because of nationalist politics, maybe they can quietly make some sort of backroom deal that restricts private capital flows in a way that accelerates the technology transition. At this point, I will take what I can get.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a bad situation. I mean, the place to end this conversation is by stopping for a second and reflecting on just how bad the situation is, according to the scientists. The campaigns internationally are all to hold total warming to 1.5 degrees since pre-industrial. We're going to shoot past 1.5 in another 10 years unless we can make the pandemic pivot and come out of the pandemic on a completely different development path than we went into it. And it doesn't look like that's going to happen. I mean, and as the last IPCC report told us, once we get to around 2 degrees of warming, things are going to get really, really, really bad. We're not the only ones that know this. The ruling class is reading the same reports that we're reading. How does that change the balance of power? Does it mean that guys like Bill Gates, who are still outliers, in 3 years, they might not be outliers? Things are happening very, very quickly.
That was Tom Athanasiou, Executive Director of EcoEquity, a small California-based think tank. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out this a bit from St. Vincent's freshly released song, Pay Your Way in Pain. We had loss earlier, now we've got pain. Pure coincidence of misery, I assure you. Till next week, bye.
Show.